So we're going to start from the second chapter of Megillah Esther, the fifth pasuk. And see where it says, verse 5 in bold, there was a Jewish man in Shushan?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So we're going to get right into Mordechai and Esther. Right? To this point, the Megillah had been discussing Ahasuerus' party, requesting the queen to come out, as the Talmud says, to come out naked in front of everybody. She refuses, and then off with her head. Okay? Sorry, turn this off. I'm sorry?
I thought that was only the purview of the Palestinians, off with your head.
Off with your head? In the ancient world, didn't take much to get to off with your head. That was, Esther gets off with your head. We're introduced to Mordechai later in the game. It's interesting the way the Megillah is set up. It kind of sets up the story. We haven't even heard about Mordechai or Esther. Now, after this story has begun to play out, now we have this introduction. Okay? So there was a Jewish man in Shushan, the capital, whose name was Mordechai, son of Yair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite. So, Mordechai is described with a lot of different terms here, or a lot of different descriptions. First, he's a Jewish man in Shushan, the capital. Why is that so significant? Because Shushan's not the most Jewish of places. Okay. And who was he? Let's go to verse 6. Sorry, let's do one more verse. Who had been exiled from Jerusalem along with the exiles who had been exiled with Yechoniah, king of Judah, who Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had exiled. So a little bit of history here, just to explain this verse. So Nebuchadnezzar, or Nebuchadnezzar in English, is the king of, ruler of, Babylon, okay? And he's the one who destroys the first temple. Now, 11 years before he destroys the temple, the Jews try to make peace with him, okay? And he really didn't like their king, Yechoniah, and the Jewish people worked out a deal that if they exiled their king and replaced him with a new king, then Nebuchadnezzar would hopefully leave them alone, okay? So 11 years before the temple is destroyed, Yechoniah is exiled with the acceptance of the Jewish people, but along with him is a number of the leaders as well. It's not just him; it's the Sanhedrin. It's the leading rabbis of the time as well. So basically, they clear out all leadership, and part of that group is Mordechai. Okay, so Mordechai is exiled well in advance, 11 years in advance of the Jewish people, of the temple being destroyed. Why is that significant? In some ways, it gives him an 11-year head start at kind of building relationships with figuring out this new kingdom. Now, others as well. Daniel is part of this group, and Daniel becomes one of Nebuchadnezzar's closest advisors, and that's what the book of Daniel is all about, is Daniel's role in the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar. Okay?
So Esther wasn't raised Jewish household. Is that correct?
Well, she's raised with Mordechai. She's with Mordechai the whole time.
And Mordechai is her uncle? Or?
So yeah, we'll get to that next. Yeah, we'll get to their relationship. First, we'll talk about Mordechai, then we'll get into Esther. But Esther's not mentioned. And just Esther might be born well after they're exiled. Right? Oh. So it's very possible she's
Is Hadassah just another name for Esther?
Yeah, we'll get into the names. Yeah, we'll get into the names. So we'll get into that. We'll go piece by piece.
Right.
So he's exiled 11 years before the temple is destroyed. The temple is destroyed 11 years later, but the Babylonian empire is very short-lived and is overtaken by the Persian Empire. Right, the Persians and the Medes. Okay, and first it's Darius the Mede. He's the one who kind of takes over and defeats the Babylonian empire. Nebuchadnezzar. It's not Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar has already been kind of usurped or replaced by the time the Babylonian empire is destroyed. So he himself is not the one who's actually in charge when the Persians destroy them. But pretty soon after the destruction of the temple, the Persians are now in control. So now Mordechai, who was exiled by the Babylonians, is now living in the Persian Empire. Okay, and the Persian Empire is much more expansive than the Babylonian Empire ever was. Okay, and they rule. You know, it's an empire, it's the biggest empire that had ever existed to that point in the history of the world, and probably is the biggest empire to ever exist besides the empire of Alexander the Great. Okay.
Did it take what is Israel now?
Israel is under it goes from Babylonian rule to Persian rule.
Persian
right. Right. And the truth is the only time during the Second Temple period where Israel is completely sovereign by the Jewish people is that the Hasmonean period, basically after the Jews kick out the Greeks in the Hanukkah story, through the Hasmonean dynasty, although the Greeks are still around, it's a complicated relationship, right? They kind of work something out, but they have the most independence during the Hasmonean dynasty. But the Second Temple is built when Israel is still under Persian rule, okay? So they need explicit permission from the Persian Empire to build the temple, okay? So the first major emperor of the Persian Empire is a man by the name of Cyrus, okay? And Cyrus gives the Jews permission to build the temple, to rebuild the temple. However, it's short-lived. He ends up taking it back. And according to the Talmud Achashverosh, definitely didn't let them rebuild the temple. It's not till later that they're able to rebuild the temple in full. So anyway, just some of the background, that Mordechai is living now. So he starts off being exiled by the Babylonians, but ends up living in Shushan, which is a city of Susa. And English is called Susa. And actually, the last 100 years or so, they've really, I've got some great pictures if you want to see them. They excavated the site of where Shushan was. And they've been able
to. Is it in Israel?
No, it's in Persia.
Oh, it's in Persia. Oh,
yeah, it was in Persia, yeah. And they basically uncovered a majority of the city. Let me get my book. I got this new book. It's really cool.
That's
Iran.
That's Iran.
Jewish rule now. Why aren't we rebuilding the third temple? Why aren't we rebuilding the third temple?
Because we're not together yet. Jews are just, we're all going.
And isn't there a huge Muslim mosque sitting on the spot that we need to do?
Yeah, but we can't even start it. Right? We can't
do
start
what?
Until well, building the third temple. Because
that's a whole other conversation.
What?
Yeah, no, that we haven't done.
Because we're not ready, right? Because there's
we wouldn't even know where to start, to be honest. Yeah, without the thinking is we need the Messiah to even help us understand how to do it and what to do.
How to do it and what to do.
Yeah. So there's been a tremendous amount. Here it is.
It's complicated, like the movie.
So here's a gorgeous aerial view of the remains of the city of Shushan, including the palace. I'll pass it around.
Wow,
it's gorgeous.
Now this is the Israelis
excavated this.
I know local people as well. I mean, I think this goes back 150 years. They started excavating the site.
Really quick, I've got maybe a stupid question, but I'm going to ask because I just want to know.
Please.
Okay, so like Persia, like I know that because you know prior to like the last 50 years, Iran and Iraq were Persia before, right? But what would be like Babylon? Where what part of the
Syria,
like,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's more Mesopotamia. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, Syria, Lebanon. Well, Lebanon probably is more ancient Israel, really. Yeah, probably more Syria. Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, this is what it looks like today. They uncovered that temple. They uncovered
and
it's still together. I mean, it's still, wow.
And if...
Well, sand is a really good preservative. Like, you know? Yeah, look at the Egyptian... I mean, pyramids and
that
stuff.
That is amazing.
The mummies and everything.
Well, the mummies were...
I know, but they were. It's the dry conditions that really.
Oh, that's very pretty. I wouldn't think that the Iranians would allow that to happen.
Well, it's funny. It's a remote city now. It's not really in a major area. It's not really, and it's it's part of their history.
It might have been before the Ayatollah Khomeini and all that.
It was well, they found this well before that. So this city,
that's right.
You would think that he'd have it bombed or something or nuked.
Well, the city, so the capital of Shushan, so that there's a few different capitals in the Persian Empire.
Yeah.
One was Persepolis and one was Susa with Shushan. So it goes back and forth, and they were both, you know, supposed to be spectacular cities.
Well, and they might have spun it that it's theirs anyway.
It's their right. It's really their it's their history. It's not really it's not really Jewish history to them, right? The,
really?
Well, the story of Purim is only a small footnote in in Persian history.
Oh, I see.
Hundreds of years of a major empire. These are the capital cities. If anything, it represents their proud history. I mean, the fact that there's
and
a Jewish story connected to it is very minor.
Were top people in that area too.
Well, at this time they were and they weren't.
No.
Yeah.
After probably.
Yeah.
Once Mordechai and that whole gang.
Well, after Mordechai, they soon begin to come back to Israel and rebuild the Second Temple.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. That happens pretty soon afterwards. So they're not, I mean, they're, but there's always, they're always around, and the Jews never really leave Persia, Babylonia.
No.
They never, even when the Second Temple is built, there's still a large amount of Jews that remain in other cities. Anyway, this is a really cool book. I just got this.
That's
beautiful. Yeah. Anywho, so they're in this city of Shushan, and Mordechai is a very unique figure because the way he's described here is a Jewish man in the Shushan, the capital. He is really trying to embed himself in this world, right? While most Jews, if they're in Shushan, they're pretty assimilated, and most are not living in the capital, right? You can live anywhere. They don't have to live in the capital. And the Persian Empire, what they were known for, especially because of Cyrus, was they were not the type of empire whose goal it was to force you to become them. Okay, they were very unique in that they want people to pay tribute to them and to consider themselves under Persian rule, but they allowed local customs and religions to exist. Right, so they looked at themselves almost like a
They were becoming more like Persians, less like Jews.
The Jews were, but not because they were forced to be, right?
No, well,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's like
right. So
like
if,
here.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. Whatever. Right. So it, right. Exactly. It was much more like an American situation than communist Russia.
Right.
Right. This wasn't the Greeks coming in and trying to turn everything into Greece. That was not the way
the
Persians operated.
Position, trying to turn everybody into a Catholic.
Right, right. So, I mean, the Persians didn't even have much religion. They eventually had Zoroastrianism, I believe it's pronounced. But they were not a religious group per se. That wasn't their focus. They weren't building, you know, monuments to God so much. They were a lot more about, this is our culture. You know, they were very advanced in architecture and in agriculture and things like that. That was more their focus. And they would build roads, and they built cities, and they built all these things. But it wasn't to the gods in the same way you have with Greece, you know, and Rome. So it's within this context. So Mordechai is, you know, he's embedding himself in the heart of the capital, where the action is. Now, in some ways, he puts himself at risk, right? Because he's in their face, right? He's in everyone's face. He's in Haman's face, right? He doesn't have the problem of not bowing down to Haman if he's living 200 miles away, right? But he chooses to live there. There's some very interesting midrashim about Haman's relationship to Mordechai. There's a fascinating midrash that says they knew each other for like decades.
Really?
Yeah. And that the story goes, it's told, you know, take it or leave the story, as far as the historical accuracy of it. But the story told is that Cyrus had approved, like I said, Cyrus had approved the Jews to rebuild the temple. Okay, and there are a lot of people who, locals, you know, other nations living in Israel, who wanted to stop it. Right, they didn't want to come back. They didn't want the Jews to get too much sovereignty and control over the area. So there's this big debate happening, and Cyrus calls, wants representatives from each side to come to him to plead their case. And then he'll decide, you know, should they stop or continue or halt this process. So the Jews choose Mordechai to make their case, and the non-Jews choose Haman to make their case. Okay, Haman's from Amalek, and Amalek was based in Israel, so he has his base, you know, his backing from there. So the story goes that they had to travel together, right? They travel together from Israel to probably Persepolis, wherever Cyrus was at the time. He's usually in battle, so wherever he was. And they had to travel together. And the story goes that they had a certain allotment of food, and Mordechai was rationing his food because he knew he had a long journey through dangerous areas, and Haman just kind of ate his food and finished it, and still a long way to go. So basically he made it, so Haman's begging Mordechai for food, and Mordechai says, I will give you food if you promise to subjugate yourself to me. Okay? So Haman said, okay, I'll do it. What can I do? I'm starving. So Mordechai takes off his shoe, and they sign a contract on his shoe. And the way the story goes is that Mordechai would take the shoe with him everywhere, and every time Haman would come out in public, he'd show him the shoe. Right? And that's what got Haman so mad.
Is that
Mordechai was like flaunting this, or like, you know, I don't know. That's a story in the Midrash. Again, take it or leave it, but it's an interesting little backstory. What?
Should have thrown the shoes.
So who was Haman? I mean, was he, what did he do? I mean, who was Mordechai? Were they?
So Mordechai had been a leader in Israel before the temple was destroyed. He was on Sanhedrin. So he was one of the, and he was exiled because he was a leader. Already had this reputation. He already was well known in the Jewish community. So he was a person who made sense to be a leader. But he's kind of he's hanging out in Persia. He's hanging out in the heart of the capital city. And the way he's described, he's always hanging around the palace. He always seems to know what's going on. He's always around the palace. So he almost views his role as being this emissary, a spy, or whatever, something where the liaison, let's say. He wants to make sure that if things are happening, he knows about it, and he can try to influence it. Right? That's the way he views himself. Okay? So he's a very interesting character. Right? But of course that someone puts Esther at risk, because the more well-known he is, and the closer they are to the capital, when this whole thing plays out of finding women to be, you know, the queen, so she's going to be known. They're right there. And to a certain extent, that puts them at more of a risk. Okay, so that's Mordechai. And who is Esther? So verse 7, and he had reared Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, since she had neither father nor mother. The girl was finely featured and beautiful, and when her father and mother had died, Mordechai adopted her as his daughter. Okay, so
he's her uncle, but he adopted her.
So he is her first cousin. That's the way Talmud describes it.
I was wondering why they didn't say cousin instead of uncle's daughter.
Uncle's daughter.
Uncle's daughter would be your cousin.
Your first cousin. It's your first cousin.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Why didn't they just say cousin?
It's funny that they don't really use the word cousin in the Torah. It's not really used so often. It's not really a technical term.
No,
there's niece, nephew, uncle, and aunt, but they don't really have cousin can mean a lot of different things.
Right.
So they'll define exactly how they're related. Yeah. Because you can be a first cousin in like 10 different, you know, all these different ways. Well, this is my mom's sister's daughter. This is my father's brother's wife's. Whatever.
They could marry in those days. They were marrying
first cousins. Those days, go back 50 years. Go back to the shtetl. They were marrying first cousins all the time.
Right. That's why we're all nuts.
So we're all nuts. There's plenty of reasons we're all nuts. That's just one of them, right?
There's only one reason.
There's only one reason. Marrying your first cousin was, you know, pretty common. Certainly, second cousins. It was like,
it happened.
Yeah, yeah,
in my family too.
Yeah, we don't have to go back very far usually to find things like that in our families. So, so this is her first, but obviously she's a lot younger than him because he's raising her, right? So obviously we don't know the whole story. Mordechai's uncle. You know, did he have this? It was a second marriage. He had her late in life.
Who was Mordechai?
Yeah, we don't have a name for him. Yeah, we don't have a name for him. We don't know the story. I mean, the Talmud says about them is that they both died before, or when she was born. That Esther's father died when her mother is pregnant with her, and her mother dies in childbirth. So she never knew her parents. Okay. So when it says she had neither father nor mother, it means like literally she never had a father or mother. Meaning Mordechai was always her her guardian. Okay. But it's a first cousin relationship. Now, we don't really hear about Mordechai's wife. Okay.
Did he have one?
Well, we assume he had one, but maybe she died before the story happens. Oh. Right? Because, again, Mordechai can't be that young.
No, if you said he knew Haman for years.
Right. He must be, oh. Well, if he's exiled 11 years before the temple is destroyed, then the temple is destroyed. Right? And then the Persians take over. So there's a whole dispute, you know, trying to figure out how many years, you know, the different kings of Persia ruled, and it's so long ago we've got incomplete information. But this is
But he had no children of his own except for Esther.
You know, we don't know. It's not part of the story. You know, what's funny about the Megillah, you know, the Megillah is written in a very funny way because it was written during the lifetime, their own lifetime, and it was written when Ahasuerus was still alive.
And who wrote it?
So we assume that Mordechai wrote it, right? But he had to write it very carefully, like right?
Biography.
Yeah, well, it's about the story, but he has to be very careful how he presents people, right? He has to be very careful about what he says and what he doesn't say. So there's a few times when, you know, we assume he had to be just very subtle about things or not get into things that weren't really part of the story. So he doesn't give very much background all of this. And we'll get into the question of where Esther and Mordechai married. So according to the opinion they were married, right? Then why does it mention it? Well, maybe because that would make Ahasuerus look bad. If he had taken a married woman, that would be complicated. Right? So that's part of the question. We have a hard time with parts of the Megillah. We don't have enough information, partly because they're writing it very, very carefully. This was a very public document. Right? This is a very public document.
Why would he have written it?
Mordechai?
Uh-huh.
No, I mean, he wanted the story to last throughout Jewish history. They wanted to establish Purim as a Jewish holiday. In order to do that, the story needs to be told and the story needs to be remembered. So they want... and. The only one who could really write this story, who knew the details, was really Mordechai.
How were these stories, when they were preserved, with all the tumult that's going on with the Jewish people, and they were had to leave?
No, it's a good. Where, well, look, we kept.
Even the Torah. I mean, whatever.
No, so it's clear that the Jews kept a certain, you know, they kept Torahs alive, right? That's what they did. Yeah. They had enough that they could keep the story going and keep the accuracy, which, yeah, was not easy. But we go back, you know, we have, you know, from the Dead Sea Scrolls, we've got, you know, from the Second Temple period, we have excerpts from all the prophets and Torah and things like that, and it's pretty much the same as we have today. So that's going back, you know, more than 2,000 years. So obviously they did a very good job of keeping that, but you're right, exile from the temple, kicked out. I mean, there are always Jews who remained in Israel, and I'm sure when the Jews were exiled, they took with them these things, took with them Torahs. But I mean, this becomes part of the Torah, so it becomes part of what's kept. Okay, so she has two names, Hadassah and Esther. So Hadassah means myrtle in Hebrew, and then Talmud is all these myrtle. What? Myrtle. The
myrtle.
Yeah,
myrtle.
Yeah. Like Hadass, right? Hadassim. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So all these reasons given as to why. Some say she had a greenish complexion, so it's green. Some say because, you know, it tastes good to some, it tastes good. All these reasons the Talmud given why that was her name. But she has a second name of Esther. So why does she have a second name? Okay. So, again, there's a lot of reasons given for this. I think the one that makes the most sense, the question is, when did she get the second name? Did she get it when she was young? Or was she given this name as she was being taken, right? And it seems that she's given this name because Mordechai does not want her to be known as Jewish. And Hadassah is a Hebrew name, a Hebrew word.
And Esther isn't.
And Esther isn't, right? Esther is some sort of amalgamation of Aramaic and different things.
Oh, really?
But it's not straight Hebrew.
Really?
Yeah, Esther doesn't really mean anything in Hebrew.
It doesn't
have a direct translation to anything. It becomes a Jewish name, but I'm saying at the time, what does it even mean? So the most prominent word within the name of Esther is this.
It's gonna ask something good.
Do I disappoint you, Bertie?
No.
Okay. So it's Aleph Samech, Taf, Resh. The major Hebrew word here is these three letters.
Seter.
Right, like Seter. What does that mean? It means secret.
Ah.
Or hidden.
That makes sense. Yeah.
So the message could be to the Jewish people, she's the hidden Jew.
Oh.
Right? So the Jews would know they have one of their own in the temple, I mean in the palace. It's like a kind of a clue for them to figure out, for them to know. But it's not an overtly Jewish name that has a clear Hebrew lettering within it, and therefore when she's presented to the king, he doesn't know that she's Jewish. Okay, and then we'll see that's very important, why it's so important that he doesn't know she's Jewish. So just a little bit of a, yeah. So that could be like she's given a secret name for this particular reason, right? So that when she meets Achashverosh, when she's presented, she's not clearly a Jew. Okay.
But all these kids today, or almost all of them, have two names. At least back east, they do.
I mean, they're called by two names. That's the more
in
more yeshivish worlds and Hasidic worlds. Yeah, that's more prominent.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and the more modern Orthodox world, not so much.
Oh, really?
I
call my granddaughter Alia Tova.
Does everyone call her that, or just
Tova.
You?
I like Tova.
But do her friends call her that, or just you?
No, her friends call her Alia.
Yeah,
her Alia.
Yeah. So
I'm the only one, I think, and Maury.
Yeah.
It's not officially a thing,
kind of
but it's more in the yeshivish world that they go by two names.
Oh,
right?
Okay. Yeah. Huh. So that's what I,
I feel after the first syllable, it's like, like my sister's name is Alexandra. I never call her anything but Al.
Oh,
you know what I mean? Right. Like anything more than a syllable, I'm done.
Yeah. You're done.
Yeah.
When I used to get braggers, when I used to get angry with my kids, that middle name came
in. Wow, that's always the...
Hana, Esther, you know?
Then they know that they're in trouble.
Or
they better come in the house.
Daya Herschel, and he knew that was big time stuff.
Right. Right. Or, of course, the classic going to your spouse. You know, my wife says to me.
Do your kids have middle names?
Yes.
They do.
Yeah. Tehila Sara, Tiferet Gittel, Mi'ira Tamar, and Akiva Shmuel.
Oh, really?
That's interesting that
more common?
Yeah.
A little bit. Well,
you know,
Tehila was named after someone.
She was?
For Sarah.
Oh, really?
And Tiferet,
right,
for Sarah.
Not Tehila. That's really unusual.
Yeah.
It's so pretty.
Which is kind of, basically, we took the names that we liked, and then we put the middle name after someone.
What does Tehila mean?
It means to praise God.
Oh, okay. Because I found out Tiferet means beauty, right?
It means like grace, beauty, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not quite beauty in the classic sense. It's more like, Hebrew, it's hard to translate exactly. There's a grace to it, but it's not like beauty, like physical beauty per se. Tiferet's name, her Gittel is my wife, my grandmother.
Right.
My father's mother. She passed away about a month before
Tamara?
She was born.
Oh.
Tamara is just, we like the
name.
Thank God we didn't have a lot of people to name after,
God, right.
Thank God.
Yeah.
Especially with girls.
Right.
Tamara.
Yeah, although since Meir was born, one of Bethany's grandmother's passed away.
Tamara.
And then Akiva. Yeah, and then Akiva, so Shmuel, it was my wife's grandmother. Grandfather, I mean. So.
Grandma, really?
So we had.
Yeah.
Okay.
Alright.
So this is the relationship that's described. So he's called the Oman Et Hadasa, right? Which is kind of like the guardian. But Oman's a funny word. We usually translate it as the guardian, as the watcher of. So the Talmud goes in some funny directions here. Okay? So the Talmud says this following. So it says that the line here was, okay. Second.
I have a babysitter.
I'm trying to finish up that one.
No. I just stopped.
Okay. And he'd reared Hadassah's Esther, his uncle's daughter, since she had neither father nor mother. Okay.
Right.
So in Hebrew, Vayomer Tadasa, he asked her about the dog, Ki Ein La Av Va'ein, Vanar Yifator V'Emar, V'mot Avi Avimah L'Kacha Mordechai Lo Lebat. Okay, he took her as a daughter. Okay, so the Talmud has an opinion that takes the word bat and adds, right, bat as daughter, and adds a yud to buy it.
Buy it.
Right, buy is a home. Oh. And often that's a reference to a wife who is the steward of the home. Right, so the way the Talmud puts it is that, you know, when a man has a wife, he has a home. Until then, he's just kind of, you know.
Right.
He's just kind of around. Right.
This is true.
A single guy doesn't have a home. He's got like a temporary residence. When he's married, now he actually has a home. So that's kind of a little device, which is, you know, the Talmud has this opinion that really Esther eventually, that she gets married to Mordechai. Now the first cousin, so there's nothing technically wrong with it. But if he raises her, it's a little bit strange. So nowhere in the actual text of the Megillah does it say that they were married, but there is this view in the Talmud that they were married, and it comes up a couple different times.
It never says they're married.
Never says they're married in the text, but I'm saying, you know, right. Now, this could be, now it might not be a problem that it wasn't mentioned in the text, like we said, because if this text of the Megillah was written during Ahasuerus' lifetime, they might not want to include that because it would make Ahasuerus look bad that he's taking married women.
Right.
They were married. And, you know, Mordechai is now his established person. And at the end of the Megillah, Mordechai is now got a position of power in the government. And
he doesn't want to get beheaded.
He doesn't want to get beheaded. And it's going to make everyone look really bad if this story is really sordid. And there's a real discussion in the commentaries as to, you know, do they think Esther was married to him or not, to Mordechai or not. It really matters because the Talmud asks a very simple question, but a complicated question. And that is, how in the world could Esther have married Ahasuerus?
Yeah,
right?
Really.
How could she have married him? How could she have let this happen? Right? And it's asked in a few different ways. One way the question is asked is, there are three things a Jew is supposed to give their life for. Right? Instead of committing the sin. Idol worship, murdering somebody else, and inappropriate sexual relations. Okay? So, in this situation, she's marrying the king of Persia. This seems to be a pretty inappropriate relationship, as inappropriate as it gets. So, number one, the question is, how could she marry him? Shouldn't she have given her life? Number two, if she's married to Mordechai, now it's adultery too.
Right.
It ups the ante even more. Right? So now we've got two things happening. It's adultery, and it's marrying the king of Persia. So the Talmud asks, well, why does she do this? Right? If this is adultery, then she should have to give her life for it. So there are a few different answers that are given. The main approach here, which is offered by Tosfot in a lot of detail, and the Talmud uses this term. It says, Esther Karkam Olam Haiti, this is in Sanhedrin 74b, that she was passive. Okay? The understanding is that a woman's not responsible if she's raped. Right? It's not considered an illicit relationship if she's raped. So, in essence, Esther is raped here. Right? She is forced into this relationship. So it's not considered a real relationship. It's not considered a marriage. It's not considered illicit sexual behavior.
But isn't she supposed to give her life?
Over again? I mean,
what? I'm sorry. One time.
I'm sorry. You were speaking before
me.
No.
Go ahead.
But was it, I mean, you just said that there's three reasons
you're supposed to give your life as opposed to committing an illicit sexual act.
Right.
But that's only if you are participating in that act.
Oh,
if you
were voluntarily,
right? If you were completely passive, right? Then the argument goes: then she didn't really do anything; it was done to her. Yeah,
right.
But
okay.
If they're married or living together or whatever they're doing,
right?
This rape or whatever you're calling it is going on and on and on. I mean, it's
but they had,
a rape
had, like,
is a one time thing.
He had a bunch
well,
of
maybe
lines,
not
though, right though.
Well, look, he's got a harem.
Yeah, so, I mean, she probably was
he
in
has
rotation.
A harem. What?
She was probably in rotation.
Well, she was the queen, so she was at the top of the list. But, yes, he had a harem. And
Yeah. Well,
now,
whatever.
That's true. I guess the way the Talmud looks at it is, if she refused to be with him, uh-huh. she would be killed.
Well,
so in essence,
isn't that one of the tenets of Judaism that you should?
So I think the point is that I guess that they're looking at it that she's being constantly raped. Now, therefore, it's not her response. That if she didn't develop a relationship with Ahasuero, she never felt a connection to him, she never was doing this willingly, this was something that was forced upon her, and therefore she was not responsible for it. That's the idea.
She did it for the sake of saving her people.
Right. Right. Besides the fact that there was a greater good.
You are giving.
But the point is, right now, part of the discussion is, well, maybe the, you know, if this was done because she was Jewish, or if this was some sort of, if they were trying to force the Jewish people to change their religion, but so that could be considered differently as well.
They were going to kill them all.
Well, that's later. But when Ahasuerus marries Esther, see, part of the discussion here also in Sanhedrin is that if a Jew is in a situation where they're forced to break Jewish law publicly, right? In order to try to convince others to not keep Judaism, and that's something you give your life for. It's the story of Hanukkah, right? Where, you know, they want Matisyahu to, you know, sacrifice a pagan Eden, right? So even though that's not one of the three cardinal sins, quote unquote, since it was being done publicly and being done in a way that was trying to show the rest of the Jewish people to give up their Judaism, then Matisyahu will be obligated to give up his life, because that was a public statement. However, since Ahasuerus does not know she's Jewish, right, this can never be perceived as
Ahasuerus
trying to convince anyone, the Jews, to stop being Jewish. He doesn't even know she's Jewish.
No.
So in that sense, she's kind of removed from, you know, that whole aspect is removed from the picture.
What Bertie's saying that it's not even regarded
Jewish.
As a legitimate Jewish marriage?
It's
right?
Not a Jewish marriage. It's not.
Good question. So that's a good question. Well, the question is if a Jewish person has an affair with a non-Jew, is that still considered? It raises.
It's not that she's not even. She's not married to Mordecai, right?
She is.
Well, that's the question. That's the question. So it depends. Some
maybe after.
No, some people view that they were married, and some said they weren't. So if they weren't married, then that removes the whole issue of adultery from this discussion.
Right.
Right. And some commentaries say they weren't married. There was no adultery here. This was just a question of being with a non-Jew. And sexual relationship with a non-Jew is not not one of the capital offenses, right? When it comes to sexual morality, that means adultery and incest. Okay, it doesn't mean premarital sex. Premarital sex is not one of the cardinal sins. It's only adultery and incest. So if she's not married, there's no adultery. Though they do seem to assume this would be adultery, even though he wasn't Jewish.
Wait a second. Karen, you just said something.
Never mind. I'm so.
In other words, no, if Ahasuerus only had virgins, he's the one who.
Apparently, if she was married, she wasn't a virgin, was
right.
She wasn't a virgin.
Right.
So
Ahasuerus did not seem.
That was the whole thing in those days. Anyway,
him,
you can marry a virgin.
Yeah, he would have
right.
gotten her head off.
But that is a good question. Did he insist on only virgins or not? Although I think there's a midrash that says that Ahasuerus just to take the most beautiful woman that you can find out.
I mean, wasn't it a beauty contest that she got the you know, like it was like the equivalent of winning Miss America, and then how she became the queen.
Right.
But she was also supposed to be a virgin.
Right. Oh, okay.
I mean, all of them.
In theory, but I don't think it ever says that they had to be virgins. They had to be virgins.
All right, that's.
They're probably it's probably overlooked in the beauty contest part of it.
Yeah, it didn't seem that was a prerequisite.
Oh, okay. I don't know why I'm trying to defend.
Right.
You're just trying to defend her.
Right. Right.
Well, look,
I have a real
because your daughter's name. You really
I have a real problem with all.
No,
all
but
this
the secret
with what with
the whole thing.
No, okay.
I'm just saying. Oh. I have a problem trying to make this. It's like you're making excuses, and not you, but I mean
the Tao is making excuses
Tao is
for her.
Making excuses for her and trying to get out of it. I mean, like.
Well, yeah. It seems that from the way that the story is told, it seems that she's a hero, right? It seems that she saves the Jewish people, and it seems that ultimately this is God's plan, right?
Yeah, right.
Now, so if we're working with that assumption, then wait a second, how does this happen? So we're trying to kind of make this work. Now, look, you could easily argue this is part of the problem of being under the control of other nations, is that you're constantly put in very difficult moral dilemmas like this. You know, did she do the right thing? It seems like she did. History seems to say she did the right thing.
Right.
But within the moment, does she want to do this? Does Mordechai want her to do this? It's a really, and we hold her up and believe that she was a very righteous woman, so we obviously feel this was justified. But our sensitivities tell us this doesn't feel right. Right? Something feels off here.
Okay.
So
you've answered my dilemma.
Right. So that leaves the rabbis, you know, the Talmud to really try to explain, you know, what her thinking was and why this was not a problem. Again, it's not ideal in anyone's book. No one's saying, you know, this is, and maybe part of the message of Purim is, you know, you get yourself into these situations, it might take a lot of messy stuff to get out of them, right? Because you're going to get stuck in these situations.
I think that's happened
a lot in Jewish history.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we have here. We have a really sticky situation where technically we could probably come up with arguments as to why this works, but God, it's messy. Really messy. And so that's what we have this story. So, you know, part of the story, if they're married or not, you know, it also colors, you know, Mordechai's relationship to her. Why didn't they get divorced? Maybe they got divorced before she left. But there's no mention of a divorce either. Maybe that's a way to solve this issue.
Did Mordechai and Esther end up together after the whole thing, or did she just stay the wife of the queen?
Well, she's the queen until... It's a good question. I mean, she's the queen, though Ahasuerus, I think, seems to die pretty soon after happens. There is a very interesting statement in the Talmud that even when she was married, you know, according to the opinion that she was married to Mordechai, there's an opinion in the Talmud that she was sneaking out of the palace to see him. Right?
She had a complicated life.
So she had a complicated life, right? So even they were even married then. Again, it's really hard to know. It's really hard to know. So in the later commentaries, the Middle Ages, there's a lot of different opinions in here. We list in all the different commentaries. Some say that they were married, some say they weren't. We don't have any historical evidence. We've got the passage in Talmud that opinion, which, again, it's not necessarily something we have to take 100%. And so there's a lot of discussion about this, but with very incomplete knowledge. Which the truth is that that's a lot of the story of Purim. A lot of the story of Purim is a lot of incomplete knowledge. Because like we said, the Megillah only gives us very specific information, but leaves out a lot. And so there's a lot to be filled in. And this becomes one of the more complicated parts of this whole story.
And we're also applying like modern day thinking about things to this ancient, you know, men had multiple wives, you know, obviously we don't have that in our current society and
kings had harems.
Yeah, and I mean obviously Mordechai was like way older than her, so you know,
right,
it might have been
so
like manipulative of him to like take her as a wife. Yeah, I mean it's like
go to him.
Yeah.
What was that thing you said?
Well, that you know, like, for him to, like, look at her like that, like, it just reminds me kind of, it's a bad example, but, like, Woody Allen.
Woody Allen,
right?
I'm just thinking of Woody Allen.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, like, you know, to marry your daughter or, like, somebody that you,
I mean,
technically
well,
it wasn't
was thinking
his
right
daughter,
away,
but,
yeah.
You know, it she was young. Like, when did he look at her in that way, you know? Mm.
Yeah. That's a good question. One that I don't have an answer to.
The Rebbeim there in the Talmud had an answer either for all that.
For how he married? No, they don't
they
seem
don't.
To discuss it. I mean, everyone seems to. I mean the text seems to say pretty clearly that he raises her, That's
yeah,
pretty
raised
clear.
Her as a daughter.
All
right. Right, as a daughter.
As a daughter. All right. Right, and then right. he marries her, which is Woody Allen-ish.
Yes. Right. Unless he raised her daughter means
yeah,
as a
woman. Yeah, something that
Chinese,
we really
right.
do, unless you're like
so
a director.
It's ambiguous, like a lot of the story program. It's left ambiguous. We're still grappling to understand
That's
parts
why
of this.
Who gets shicker, Rabbi?
Who gets shicker?
No, I mean.
Oh, we get shicker?
What
you know,
shicker?
A little bit. You know,
shicker.
Drunk.
Okay.
Right. But that's you know, but that's part of the whole holiday of Purim. The whole holiday of Purim is confusion. It's
yeah.
It's pretending to be something you're not. If you don't know the whole story, that's costume. That's getting drunk. That's a lot of what Purim is. So, it's almost
drink, yeah. If I could, I'd want to drink after all.
Me too.
Right. Okay. So, and maybe that's one of the themes of Purim is that in life. There aren't always simple answers. There's a lot of incomplete information, and we try to figure things out with the best we can, knowing that we're going to be in, you know, life is not a sitcom where everything gets wrapped up at the end of 30 minutes and everyone hugs each other and moves on, right?
Yeah, right.
Life is
well,
not
and
like that.
And this obviously fell down like this because it was Hashem's will that the Jewish people be
right.
saved by it. You know, if it hadn't gone down like this.
That's what I'm saying. So this is part of the message from Hashem.
Yeah, and that is in our history. I mean, we always say, you know, Hashem was there. His name was never
right. Exactly. So.